from meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news. Broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. Welcome to the show. Everyone knows Wendy Murphy, one of my favorite guests in the program. She's a former sex crimes prosecutor. She's a victims advocate. Of course, her book, Injustice for Some, is a book that everyone should read. Click on the link in the show notes to get that. And most recently, Wendy wrote an open letter to Woody Allen, and I thought I'd bring her on the show to talk about it. Hi, Wendy.
Hey, Dana. Good to be with you.
What about Woody Allen? What's the letter about?
Well, you know, in what seems like such a complicated story, I think there really was a simple message, and that was that Dylan, obviously, Woody Allen's adopted daughter, Dylan Farrow,
right,
who, as you know, and I'm sure your listeners know, accused Woody Allen of sexual abuse many, many years ago, did so in a way that was really quite credible and compelling, and Woody Allen's response was rather predictably not so credible and not so compelling. And I think sometimes it's hard for the public to appreciate what it is about an allegation that makes it credible and what it is about a response that makes it not seem credible. So I wrote an open letter to Woody Allen after I read Dylan's piece in the New York Times blog section of Nick Kristof's page, because I wanted Woody Allen to know that his response was not special, that his accusations of Dylan not being credible and her and the reasons people shouldn't believe her were rather cliche, and that they suggested he was guilty. And so let me just explain a couple of quick points.
Sure.
One is that Dylan described one incident in particular. Obviously, the abuse she experienced went on over a period of time, but she described one incident that occurred when she was 7 years old, and the detail was very compelling. The so-called benign detail that kids often remember when they're being abused that most of us would never think about in terms of life memories, except that when you're being abused, you might notice something like the color of the carpet or, you know, the photo on the wall and so forth. So Dylan described lying on a floor on her stomach and watching a toy train go by as Woody Allen was abusing her from behind. And it's that kind of narrative storytelling from the eyes of a child that really made her sound so credible to me as an experienced ex-prosecutor who handled so many child abuse cases over the years. It's just the detail in her telling, the peripheral detail in her telling, that really rises the allegation to a level of credibility for me. Of course, none of us knows the exact truth. We weren't there. But Woody Allen said, through a statement that was issued by a spokesperson, this was his early statement, not the one he published subsequently, a longer statement, but in his original response, one of his spokespersons said, you can't really trust what a seven-year-old says because seven-year-olds can't distinguish between fantasy and reality. And, you know, having done this work for decades, it just made me shake my head and roll my eyes because that is such a common response by accused perpetrators. And it resonates with the public. You know, you're trying to understand why would a child say such a thing unless it were true. Well, if you prop up the fantasy defense, you know, some reasonable people think, well, that makes sense, that it wasn't correct and it wasn't true, but the child was fantasizing. For adults to accept that kind of excuse or explanation, they really can't possibly understand the mind of a child. So I wrote my letter to point out that people like Woody Allen, when they blame a child for fantasizing about something like sexual abuse, they're really projecting their own guilt. They're projecting their own fantasies, and their narcissism is shining through because, Dana, as you know, and I know you read my piece, which folks, by the way, can see for themselves at wendymurphylaw.com, children don't fantasize about sexual abuse, especially at 7 years old. A little girl might fantasize about being a princess. Maybe she's fantasizing about growing up to be a doctor. But she's not fantasizing about abuse. And we know that because a child that age has no context to understand it, much less imagine it or frame it as a fantasy. But an adult perpetrator who is attracted to children does fantasize. And so for somebody like Woody Allen to respond to an allegation by describing it as a fantasy of a child is really very telling. It's kind of a telltale heart revelation from an accused perpetrator. And as I wrote in my piece, when somebody is accused and they respond by saying the child is fantasizing, to me that's a red flag, very strongly correlated with guilt.
Wendy Murphy's here, and Wendy, this all started again, I guess, when there was some sort of a tribute, I never saw it, to Woody Allen, and then Dylan and others started posting on the internet, Mia Farrow, etc. What about that? What brings back that response? Because I guess it's never over for the victim, but why bring it all up again?
Yeah, I mean, that's also part of why I wrote the letter. I not only wanted to point out the silliness of, and frankly, the guilt implicit in Woody Allen's response, but I wanted to point out that one of the reasons victims do tell, even many years later, in the way that Dylan did, is because it isn't resolved for them when they feel that their truth is not yet known. And that is true for most kids, because kids often are denied access to justice, and then they grow up feeling very unsettled and unresolved, and don't people believe me, and why didn't anybody care, and why do people give awards to this man who did something so horrible? And it's frustrating. So a child who looks at a seeming hero and wants to throw things at the television, that's because they don't feel heard. And their voices really aren't heard. The vast majority of children who are abused are denied access to justice, primarily because we don't respect them enough. And I write in my book about the importance of encouraging and even pressuring, frankly, children to testify in a court of law, because the kids who do testify fare much better in the long run than the ones we, quote-unquote, protect from the stress of the system. The prosecutors, in Dylan's case, believed her. The external investigators credited her, and the prosecutor said there was probable cause to proceed, but they didn't file criminal charges because of Dylan's age. They wanted to protect her from the system. My research and a fair number of studies indicates that that's the wrong-headed approach, that children don't need to be protected from justice. They need access to justice. And had Dylan had her chance back then, perhaps this mightn't have happened, because she wouldn't have felt so silenced and so, frustrated. People are going to believe what they want about Woody Allen, but they should form their opinions based on a full exposure of the truth and not based on some PR campaign by his people to literally crush the voice of a child. There were good reasons for Dylan to speak out when she did, that people might describe as opportunistic, but it's not so much opportunism as the moment when a child, now an adult, looks at the abuser, sees him being revered and celebrated, and thinks to herself, what the hell is wrong with this country? What the hell is wrong with this world that they would revere a man based on his artistry and put out of their minds, or disregard outright the fact that he has been sexually exploitive and abusive of children. It's sort of like O.J. Simpson revisited. Okay, he may have been a good football player, but that doesn't matter anymore once you become a killer. Once you're a double murderer, your NFL status is irrelevant. It's irrelevant. And you cannot be lionized and revered in society if you hurt children, even if your films are well done, and even if you're a terrific artist. It just doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. And I think that's why Dylan did what she did. She was frustrated. She felt silenced. I hope that folks understand that that's where that comes from, because for a lot of children, they do look for opportunities to be heard. And had Woody Allen not been recognized at the Golden Globes, there might not have been as much public interest in hearing her story. So I'm glad she did it when she did it. There is absolutely no evidence that she's motivated to lie. To the contrary, she probably would have done a lot better if we measure better by, you know, how much money do you have and how much is Woody Allen going to send you in a check every month if she had stayed silent. Truth was more important to her. You know, money be damned. The same can be said for Mia Farrow. She clearly put her children ahead of whatever fame Woody Allen offered her when she was with him. Her career might have been a very different one had she not shamed him, dumped him, and supported her children. So she's quite a good mother for having given up her self-interest way back then. Now we have a strong daughter as a result of how much care her mother showed for her, and that's the way the world should be. You know, absolutely. Money isn't important, fame isn't important, and damn it, Woody Allen isn't important, nor are his films. Not when we're talking about somebody who has the capacity to destroy vulnerable and defenseless children.
Absolutely, and it's so good that she did come forward. Wendy Murphy's here for about another 5 minutes. Let's talk about the media response somewhat. Of course, we can go back to Whoopi Goldberg and her, rape comment, and your response to that. What about the media and this time around?
Yeah, well, look, let's not be naive. The media is a business, and Woody Allen can outspend Mia Farrow and Dylan Farrow all day long, every day, for the rest of their lives. And the public has to be aware. The view of media as somehow insulated from money and motivated by truth-telling, I don't think is widely appreciate it anymore. It might have been that way many, many years ago, but the fact is the media coverage originally was just one blogger's website. You know, Nick Kristof's website at the New York Times, Dylan didn't even get actual ink in an actual newspaper or even a NewYorkTimes.com space. She got a blog site from Nick Kristof, who has done a very good job exposing all kinds of sex crimes around the world against women and children, and he's been a good voice for women and children in that regard. So consider that what Dylan got by way of media coverage was tiny compared to what Woody Allen got in the aftermath, which was more than his fair share of airtime on every network and in newspapers, and he got editorials. And I just hope the public is smart enough these days not to measure truth by who has the most ink or airtime, because that's always determined by money, and children are never going to be wealthy enough to meet the kinds of money that people like Woody Allen have. And, you know, Whoopi Goldberg, I don't know what her problem is. I don't understand her response to the rape of a child from Roman Polanski times, from Roman Polanski and a time similar probably, in terms of people not respecting children. Whoopi Goldberg making the comment about, you know, it isn't rape, is a little bit akin to people saying about Woody Allen, well, he married his daughter, but it wasn't his daughter, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know what to say about that, except that when people are sycophants, when they are suck-ups to money, when they think Woody Allen's fame and fortune is more important than the well-being of a child, they'll come up with all kinds of cockamamie excuses to disbelieve the child and to side with the rich guy. And I think we had enough of that in this country. I think we've had enough of it around the world. Sometimes it's not only okay, but it's really important to stand with the voiceless, powerless child against even the profound wealth of a guy like Woody Allen.
Absolutely. Well said. Wendy, as always, thank you, ma'am.
My pleasure. Take care.
Talk to you. Bye-bye. That's Wendy Murphy. She's a former sex crimes prosecutor, and She's a law professor. She's a victim's advocate. She does all the work for the victims that can't be heard and are voiceless. And I want to share a little bit of the letter with you that she wrote to Woody Allen. Again, click on the link in the show notes or go to her webpage. And don't forget Wendy's book, Injustice for Some, an expose of lawyers and judges who let dangerous criminals go free. And now it has never-before-published facts about the JonBenet Ramsey case. Wendy's been our guest on this program for years now, one of my favorite guests. Anyway, she's not shy to speak her mind, and here's a little bit of the letter to Woody Allen. Dear Woody, if you weren't the umpteenth famous or wealthy guy accused of sexually abusing a child, I'd write that I'm outraged and I'd condemn you for being a monster. But you're not unusual, sadly. And after decades in this business, I'm tired of being outraged. Which is why I'm writing a different kind of letter to you, Woody. Most men accused of sex abuse do exactly what you did. They deny allegations and accuse the child of lying out of spite or being mentally ill, or they say the child is an innocent victim of a vindictive mother who made the child lie. In one of your statements, you say Dylan's allegations are false because a 7-year-old child cannot be trusted to distinguish between fantasy and reality. This claim makes you look particularly guilty, Woody. See, little girls fantasize about becoming princesses and doctors. They don't fantasize about being told to lie face down and watch a train go by while being sexually abused from behind. They have no context to conjure up such a fantasy. Claims that children fantasize about sexual abuse are usually the projected fantasies of guilty perpetrators. Truly innocent guys don't come up with such excuses because it never crosses their minds to consider the possibility of any child fantasizing about sexual abuse. And the letter goes on. Again, click in the show notes to learn more about that. The Woody Allens and the Roman Polanskis and the others that are out there, we hear more about the famous and the wealthy when it comes to alleged child abuse, and there's sadly, thousands and thousands of cases out there that we don't hear about are the ones that can afford to buck the system. And like Wendy said, in this case, the prosecutors who believed the victim, Dylan, but didn't want the system her to be her enemy, were just plain wrong. The system should protect children, should protect victims of rape, no matter what their age. We shouldn't be afraid of the system. We should make the system work for us. And if those in Hollywood and those with money can make the system benefit them, no matter what the charge, if they can afford the fancy lawyer and put up with the delays and go to court for years and years on end with appeals, and the victim suffers, then there's something wrong with that system. We're going to take a break, and we're going to be back here in just a minute on Scared Monkeys Radio with Dr. Dale Archer, and we're going to talk about addictions and the most recent death of Philip Seymour Hoffman. And could it have been prevented? I'm Dana Pretzer. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. Okay, we're back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. You'll know my next guest, Dr. Dale Archer. He's a clinical psychiatrist and author of the New York Times bestseller, Better Than Normal, How What Makes You Different Can Make You Exceptional. And his recent article in Psychology Today, talking about Academy Award-winning actor Philip Seymour Hoffman and the death of Mr. Hoffman, is something I wanted to bring the good doctor on and talk about tonight. Doctor, how are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. Good to be here.
Now, we're going to talk about addiction and all that in just a minute, but here we have a guy that's got the world by the tail, or did he, 46 years of age, and dies with a needle in his arm. We've heard lots of stories over the years about celebrities and others, sadly, that we don't hear about, but mainly about the celebrities that take their own lives. Why?
Well, you know, I think there are several reasons for it. First of all, addiction is an ever-growing problem here in North America. To give you an example, that we have about 600,000 heroin addicts in the U.S. right now, and we have about 2,000 deaths per year. So that's a lot of people that are dying from drugs. Number two, the majority of these are not suicide. They're accidental. And I think that that's a blurred line that the public doesn't really understand. They hear drug overdose, immediately think that it was on purpose, but a lot of these are accidental deaths. In fact, the majority are accidental deaths. And the fastest growing drug of abuse in North America today are the narcotic prescription pain pills. And as that grows and we regulate that more and more, heroin has become the default option because they can't get the pain pills, and so they're switching over to heroin.
Now, it makes sense, I guess, when somebody dies of a drug overdose that they didn't intend to die. But then again, is it accidental when you are the one that puts the needle into your arm?
Well, the thing about heroin and narcotic pain pills is that they are lethal if you take too much of them. Basically, they depress your breathing to the point where you stop breathing. With heroin, there's always the issue of you don't know how pure the drug is that you bought. So you may inject the exact same amount time after time after time, and then you perhaps get it from a new dealer, it's a stronger dose, and you take too much, you overdose and die. Pain pills, we see a lot of accidental deaths when they combine it with alcohol because that enhances the effect of the narcotic pain pill. So I get your point, but I draw the line between a suicide, which is you want to die and you do something to make that happen, versus you're doing something you know is high risk and you end up dying from it, but you didn't intend to die.
The Dr. Dale Archer is here. You can read his article about Philip Senior Hoffman on Psychology Today, and there's a link in the show notes. Now, lots of reports just in the last couple of days about Hoffman and his diaries and his talk of addiction, his talk of being in rehab and going out and making buys. The cry for help, I guess, for lack of a better term. What can we learn from not only his but others' voices after they die?
Well, I think the number one thing is that these drugs in particular are deadly, and they're the number one cause of accidental drug overdose. And again, this broad category of painkillers is what we're talking about, and heroin fits into that, even though it's illegal. It's still in the same category. But these are deadly drugs, and they're the most addictive drugs on the planet. And so you're fooling yourself if you think, oh, I'm doing this recreationally just to party and just to get high and just to have a good time, because you can be addicted literally in a matter of a week or two. And in fact, the one big thing that I see frequently is an individual comes in to get treatment for addiction, and they start off with an injury, perhaps a knee or a back. They're prescribed narcotic pain pills. They get addicted to it without even knowing it. And when they come to see me, they said, you know, I had pain, and I took the pills, and then I needed more pills because they weren't working. And the next thing you know, I liked the high from the pill more than I needed the pain relief. And at that point, they became an addict. So I think that's a message that we just have to get out there, that these are lethal. They are potentially lethal, and everyone needs to be aware of that. And it's an epidemic. It's just growing beyond anything that I can imagine at this point.
Dr. Dale Archer is here. Talking about addiction, in the article you talk about once an addict, always an addict, regardless of your sex, race, or creed. And the four C's of addiction are something that I want you to talk about with the audience a little bit.
Yeah, we talk about the four C's of addiction, which are loss of control, continued use despite bad consequences, a compulsion to keep on using, and craving. And I'll talk about each of those quickly. When we talk about a loss of control, you no longer have the ability to just have one, whether it's a drink, whether it's a pill, whether it's even a tote of marijuana. So you say, I'm going to go out and have one drink, but you have that one drink, and a flip of the switch occurs inside your brain, and you can't say no. Consequences would be you lost a job, you have a DUI, you have legal problems, you lose your family, your kids, your wife, because of the fact that you are using these drugs. Compulsion means you think about it all the time, you have a desire, and then a craving is really the last of the four C's, but probably the most important when it comes to the full-on addictive process. And that means that you're either high on the drug or you're craving the drug. And this is a craving that comes from deep within the limbic system, the emotion center of the brain. And basically, this brain center, it finds that it enjoys the euphoriagenic aspect from the drug and starts to give the message that you function better and feel better and do better with this drug in your system. And so it's actually sending out messages to the rest of the brain saying, get more drugs, get more drugs, get more drugs. That's the craving we're talking about.
Now, they talk about Hoffman and his relapse, that term relapse, after 23 years of sobriety. And many will ask the question, why did he relapse?
Well, you know, we have a saying in the addiction field, once an addict, always an addict. And I had a lot of critiques for saying that in the blog, saying, well, that's ridiculous. People get sober all the time and go on to live the rest of their life. And that's true. But you can be clean. You can be clean and sober, but it doesn't mean you don't have that addict potential. Because what we're seeing now is that there's a genetic component. There's a brain chemistry difference that occurs in addicts versus everyone else. And there are a lot of different theories in terms of what causes this, but essentially it appears that these brains that are susceptible to addiction get a much higher high than the average person when they take this drug or any drug, and then they have a much greater crash when the drug isn't there. So it's heightened at both ends of the extreme, and this is what sets up the brain to become an addict brain. And no matter how long you're sober, no matter how long you're clean, you still have that brain. So that's how you can go for 20 years, and the average person would say, well, man, I kicked this thing. Right. I've been sober for 20 years. But if you do have a drink or you do have a drug, it's going to trigger the exact same mechanism in your brain that caused you to become an addict in the first place. So that's why, even though many people say, you know what, we have meds now that can control all this, but the best way to maintain sobriety, if you have the addict's brain, is not to do anything to trigger. And that would be no drinks, no drugs, nothing that has an addiction potential should go in your body, because you are at high risk every day for the rest of your life.
Dr. Dale Archer's here. We're talking about the addiction, the problem with addiction. Lots of talk, doctor, across the United States, Washington State, Colorado, up here in Canada, the big push to decriminalize or legalize marijuana, the addictive aspect that comes into that. The opponents will say that it's a gateway drug that starts the addiction. The proponents will say that's nonsense. What about that? Are we being too liberal when it comes to decriminalizing something that you may get addicted to?
No, absolutely not. And I'm a strong proponent of marijuana being legalized. In fact, I would say with the right controls in place that we should legalize many drugs. And I know that sounds contradictory, but hear me out. Basically, just because a substance has the potential to be addictive,
right,
doesn't mean it needs to be illegal. It needs to be regulated, needs to be controlled, needs to be monitored. Alcohol, of course, is a classic example. There are hundreds of thousands of individuals that drink alcohol, and out of those, a small percent do become alcoholics. So it has a addictive potential, no doubt about it. So I don't think that by making it illegal, we are helping the problem. I would much prefer to see these things be legalized, especially with respect to marijuana, which I personally feel, and much of the research would validate, is safer overall than alcohol. So let's legalize it, let's tax it, and let's use that tax money to put treatment programs in place to help people that do end up developing a problem. There's no doubt that you can become addicted to marijuana. It's not common, but it's there. And there's no doubt that for these individuals that do, that they do often need to be treated, and abstinence is often going to be what they have to be looking at. But we can offer that treatment. Making it illegal is not going to stop someone from becoming addicted. And I think that that is the mindset that we've got to change in North America, is that, look, legalization does not mean in any way, shape, or form we're going to be condoning the fact that this is an addictive drug. It means that a lot of people, majority of people, can take it and not become addicted and do just fine.
Dr. Dale Archer's here. Last question, Doctor. We use the term enabler quite often. Go back to even the days of Elvis Presley and the enablers that were there that would help him get the prescription drugs, that would help him do what he was doing. Reports, some of them were crazy, in the media about Philip Seymour Hoffman. Should we punish the people who sold him the drugs, which I thought were, that was probably one of the stupidest things that they've ever reported on. But what about that? What about the enablers that are out there? And what about the signs that a family member or a friend should look for if you suspect someone has an addiction?
Well, of course, an enabler is anyone who benefits from someone being addicted. So that could go all the way to the cartels that bring in the drugs or make the drugs, to the dealers that sell the drugs. But it goes further than that. And we often think of family enablers as individuals that actually support the person who is a drunk or who is a stoner or who has the addiction, because they get some benefit from that. Often that benefit is power and control. They have control over the individual when they're stoned, when they're high, and because of that, they turn a blind eye to the fact that this person has an addiction. We often see it with celebrities, in that if you're an enabler with a celebrity, help them get their drugs, hang out with them when they're high, then you get to be friends with a celebrity. And so that's the vested interest that this person has. It's a very real phenomenon, and literally why when we treat someone with addiction, we always say you have to let go of any friend that you have that is a user, because they are a setup for you to fall back into the exact same pattern again. So oftentimes that means they have to get a whole new group of friends, or the individual they do change. Choose to hang out with, that we would also want to put them into some type of treatment to say, look, you got to get sober too if you want to stay married to so-and-so, because otherwise this just isn't going to work.
Right, right, exactly. Dr. Dale Archer, thank you. You can read the article at Psychology Today. Click on the link in the show notes. Always a pleasure, my friend. Thanks a lot.
Good to be here.
Take care.
Have a good
bye-bye.
Take care.
That's Dr. Dale Archer, and he is a friend of the program and someone who has a good idea as far as what's going on when it comes to these sorts of things. I'm Dana Pretzer. That is the talk of Philip Seymour Hoffman. Now, we've heard lots in the media about Philip Seymour Hoffman, and we've heard lots about the next celebrity that may be down the line, the addiction, the marijuana issue, you name it, it's there. But is it something that we're going to be able to decriminalize or legalize, tax it, and then use that money to help fund those who have had problems with addiction? I don't know. It's hard to say, but nevertheless, someone as talented as Philip Seymour Hoffman, who's found dead with a needle in his arm, an Academy Award winner and a brilliant actor, obviously had demons so deep that he wasn't able to control them. And Dr. Dale Archer is one that is able to help and help you understand this a little bit better. I'm Dana Pretzer. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. And we are back. Whether it's Philip Seymour Hoffman, Janis Joplin, you name it, Elvis Presley, the celebrities we hear about, again, just like with the abuse of children, the sexual abuse of children, we hear about the celebrities. When it comes to these overdose deaths, because why? The people are interested. Again, the whole role model issue, when we talked about Philip Seymour Hoffman in the media, it was all about his work, which is fantastic. I think it's great to talk about the work that he did. Again, I don't buy the fact that you accidentally overdose totally, because you're the one that sticks that dirty needle in your arm, whether you're addicted or whether you're not. You know, 23 years of sobriety, and then it falls off, and then you have whatever the news reports, and they bounced all over the place, 50 packages of heroin, cocaine, you name it, in his room, the scribbled notes, whatever, to say that someone accidentally overdosed, you take the chance.
when you do something like that, you take the chance. Is it like Russian roulette where you, you know, keep pulling the trigger and hopefully it's not going to be that chamber with the bullet in there? Yeah, that's exactly what I think it is. Where I disagree with Dale Archer, and Dale's a friend and a good friend of the program. He's been coming on here for years. He's a very highly qualified psychiatrist. Is to legalize drugs, most drugs, is not right. It takes away from that accountability. To say that, yeah, you can put whatever you want in your body is one thing. But when you put something into your body that harms you, and yeah, I know some of the people out there will say, what about the obese? What about you having that cheeseburger? Or what about you having that extra shot at the bar? That will harm you too. But when you put something in your body like heroin, which you know for sure will harm you, that liability out there is, it outweighs. And to not punish the person that sold it to you, or not punish you for possessing it. Nobody's talking about Philip Seymour Hoffman and others possessing illegal drugs. No one's talking about Justin Bieber possessing illegal drugs. Marijuana is illegal to have, okay? They talk about that, and they talk about this kid who has all these, you know, these problems, and they laugh about it. And yeah, marijuana is almost decriminalized or legalized, whatever. But you can be addicted. You heard the doctor. You can be addicted to marijuana. You can be addicted to alcohol. You can be addicted to gambling. So what do we do about the problem of addiction? How do we help those that can't help themselves, that they have that craving, as Dr. Archer said? And I encourage you to click on the link in the show notes to read his article about Philip Seymour Hoffman and his talk about addictions. His comment, once an addict, always an addict, and I've had many guests on this program, doctors and prosecutors and addiction specialists say that, and they always seem to get flack for it. But once an alcoholic, you're always an alcoholic. You're never cured. It's too bad you couldn't be. It's too bad you couldn't get that one magic pill that would cure you of that heroin over that heroin addiction, or that alcohol addiction, or that gambling addiction, or that addiction to whatever it is. But it's not out there. Yeah, we have to keep working on it. Philip Seymour Hoffman was a fantastic actor, Academy Award winning actor, but he was a junkie. He was a junkie that fell off the wagon and stuck a dirty needle or a needle in his arm, and he took too much. How do we know it was accidental? Is he here to answer that question? Is Philip Seymour Hoffman, I ask you this as a legitimate question, how do we know that he didn't intend to give himself too much? Is there a note? You know, you look as an investigator to see if there's a note, a suicide note. Maybe there was, and we haven't heard about it. I don't know. I'm speculating. But how do we know this? We don't. So when you take that chance, there is no such thing, in my opinion, as a junkie, someone who's taking heroin, getting an accidental overdose. It's no accident when you put that needle in your arm. Anyway, a ways back, I interviewed Mike Wolf from American Pickers. I've had a couple of requests to re-air that interview. Mike is talking about his book, Kid Pickers, and it's a short interview, and I thought you'd get a kick out of hearing it one more time. Okay, welcome back. If you have been living under a rock, you'll still know that Mike Wolf is one of the creators and stars of American Pickers on the History Channel. If you haven't been living under a rock, then you know that the American Pickers is one of the most popular shows on cable TV. We love it up here in Canada. And Mike is has a new book called Kid Pickers, How to Turn Junk into Treasure, and it's a big thrill to have Mike on the phone with me. How you doing, Mike?
I'm doing very well. I just got home last night. I was on the road for 3 weeks. So, you know, when I come home, it just reminds me of everything I work hard for. You know, my wife is here, my daughter's here, and it just, you know, there's no place like home.
Yeah, but 3 weeks on the road with Frankie Fritz, that must be a story in itself, isn't it?
That's a little bit difficult. You know, him and I have known each other since eighth grade, and, you know, we go back and forth a little bit. But the thing is, at the end of the day, it's like we're like brothers. I mean, Frank is actually the godparent to my nieces. He's very close to my younger brother as well.
When you look at the story of American Pickers and what you do And some of the most popular programs that I've seen on your show is when you have had your nephew on picking with you. And the people that you talk to, I know you always ask them the question, when did you get started? And they always say, when I was a kid. What brought you to, and I think I know the answer, to write the book Kid Pickers?
Well, basically, I was a kid picker. I started when I was 4 years old. But after the show aired, I pitched the show for 4.5 years, and everybody kept telling me nobody's going to watch it. But then when it aired, we started getting all these letters from kids from all over the country and all over the world. We had a voicemail message on our machine in our Iowa store the other day from two little kids, little boys from Australia. And they were asking us to come over there. So, it's, you know what, when you have a child's attention for an hour program, that's very difficult to do. But every child is a treasure hunter. They have that sense of curiosity, adventure. They want to discover. So that's why I wanted to write this book, because basically there's nothing out there like this. This is just a guide for children to understand, you know, the importance of their community and their family's history. And when they find things, they can learn about both of those. It also talks about recycling. It talks about repurposing. There's even a chapter in there on how kids decorate their rooms in vintage. So we've covered it in a lot of different layers.
Tell us about your first pick.
Oh, my first pick was a bicycle I found in the alley, walking to school. I was 4 years old. My mom couldn't afford a babysitter. She was a single mother. So as soon as she could get me in school, she put me in school. So I was walking a block away from school, and I'd always cross this bike with, and it was in the weeds behind a garage. And finally I asked the guy if I can have it. He gave it to me. I cleaned it up a little bit. I wiped it down. An older kid down the street gave me $5 for it, and I was hooked.
There you go. Mike Wolf from American Pickers is here talking about his new book, Kid Pickers. There's a link in the show notes on how to pick up the book. When you talk to kids, and again, I referenced your nephew and some of the programs that you've done when you've taken him out picking, and the fact about starting out early as a child picking, it's a little bit different from what you and Frank do on the program, going through some old buildings and stuff, to what you're trying to talk to and teach kids about their first pick. Maybe talk about the best places to pick for a kid.
Yeah, you know, in the book we talk about estate sales, we talk about garage sales, we talk about auctions and flea markets, and explain, you know, what those things are and the kind of things they might possibly find there. Frank and I used to set up at flea markets. We did one down here in Nashville, Tennessee, and I just was always amazed by watching children at the flea market, what they would pick up. And I would ask them, why did you pick that up? Why do you like that? And children have such a vulnerable, fresh, creative eye, and the way they explain things and why they like things. The book doesn't really talk about monetary value. That's not important. It's basically what they like. And a kid's imaginations, you know, if they don't have a story behind something, which the book teaches, hey, every piece has a story, well, then they create a story in their mind. It's a very creative, really unique process.
When you started the show and you were trying to pitch it, did you ever think that it would take off to what it has today?
Absolutely not. I mean, you know, for a long time I pitched it and I almost gave up on it towards the end. And then the company that makes my show is in Canada. It's called Cineflix, and they're in Toronto. And that's actually one of the reasons you guys have a version of it up there called Canadian Pickers. They just recently sold the franchise to Australia. Now they're filming Australian Pickers. So it's a worldwide thing. The way I came up with the name of the show is I picked Italy in 2001, and I came across French pickers and English pickers and Italian pickers, and I was thinking to myself, I'm the American picker.
You started out at four. What's your recommendation to parents if their kids come to them and say, I want to start picking like Mike and Frank?
Well, you know what? I mean, if they came to them and said that, that would be great, because what you're doing is you're getting your child's away from a computer, away from a smartphone, away from a video game.
Yeah.
And we have a lot of parents that come in the store and they're like, hey, me and my son picked our way here. We went to a flea market here. We went to an estate sale here. You know, I mean, there's all different kinds of picking. You don't have to dig through an old building or anything like that to be picking. You could be picking at a local garage sale, and that's what the book expresses to children.
It started and it's turned out to be a phenomena. American Pickers is still one of the most popular programs up here in Canada. It's on every day. We have Canadian Pickers, and Mike says now Australian Pickers, but the thing to remember is Kid Pickers. That's the book from Mike. You can pick it up on Amazon and all your book retailers. There's a link in the show notes. Mike Wolf, it's been a big pleasure. Thank you, sir. I know you're busy today.
Yeah, thank you so much. It was an honor. Thank you for the opportunity.
Take care. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
And that's Mike Wolfe from the History Channel's American Pickers. I thought you'd get a kick out of hearing that again. Anyway, thanks to Wendy Murphy and my buddy Dale Archer, Dr. Dale Archer, for coming on the program. And, of course, Mike Wolfe from History Channel's American Pickers. Make sure and check out that show on History Channel in the United States and in Canada. And pick up his book, Kid Pickers. It's a good book to for the young people to learn about a hobby instead of, like he says, sitting in front of the computer every day or the smartphone or whatever. My name's Danny Pretzer. This is my hobby, is to entertain you. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you will join us here next time on the Danny Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio.
You've been listening to the Danny Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.